Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
Today is Tuesday, August 14th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out what Fresno County is doing to enhance mental health care at schools across the region. From urban to rural, it's a major new project, investing over $100 million in everything from suicide prevention to triage for students who might be dealing with a mental health issue. We'll also talk to a top cancer researcher and find out what he has to say about the verdict handed out last week in the trial of Johnson versus Monsanto. Does Roundup cause cancer? And where do other cases go from here? But we begin our program today looking at another agricultural chemical and concerns about its effect on human health. In our 2017 series, Contaminated, we told the stories of communities throughout the San Joaquin Valley struggling to access safe drinking water. Since then, the state has begun regulating a new drinking water contaminant. And though that regulation comes with accountability, there are also financial challenges, and communities are turning to the courts to help pay for water treatment. FM89's Carrie Klein brings us this story from Del Rey, an unincorporated community in central Fresno County.
Maria Ayala really likes to cook, but recently, this Del Rey clothing seller says cooking's become complicated. Earlier this year, she received a letter explaining some of Del Rey's water contains a carcinogen known as 123-TCP.
Ahorita estamos comprando...
She says she now buys bottled water for cooking and drinking, but the costs add up.
Ahorita lo que no sé es si el agua sirve para bañarse. No me ha pasado nada.
And she's confused about whether she can bathe or do laundry in the water. That's why Carlos Arias wants to fix the 123 TCP problem quickly.
And this is well number three.
He's the manager of Del Rey's Community Services District, and he's showing me one of the five drinking water wells scattered throughout the community.
What you're seeing here is the well and the pump.
A pipe into the ground is hooked up to a few gauges in a 15,000-gallon tank the size of a small school bus.
So actually the water comes out of the well, goes to the reservoir, and from there is distributed to the different places.
In order to filter out 123 TCP, Del Rey will have to install filtration systems on four of its wells. Between construction and long-term maintenance, a contracting company estimated it had cost more than $18 million, and that was in 2017. The estimate has since risen due to steel tariffs and other factors.
We can afford to do it. The district itself doesn't have enough money. The people in the Ray can't afford it.
Instead, he hopes a lawsuit can help, and so do dozens of other Valley communities in a similar situation. First, some background. 123 TCP is a chemical that was used until the 1980s in pesticides, fumigants, and industrial solvents. California added it to its list of cancer-causing chemicals in 1992, but the State Water Board began regulating the chemical only late last year. Now, like other contaminants, 123 TCP has a maximum level allowed in drinking water. That legal limit helps hold water districts accountable for providing safe water, but for small, unincorporated communities like Del Rey, the cost can be prohibitive. This irony isn't lost on Andrea Ventura, Toxics Program Manager with the nonprofit Clean Water Action.
We think it's a very credible tension. It's a real-world tension.
As of June, wells from more than 220 water systems throughout California tested over the limit for 123 TCP. Almost two-thirds of those are located in the San Joaquin Valley. Ventura says that's a familiar pattern.
It's a very sad story in California because this is a contaminant problem in drinking water throughout the state, but primarily in our rural communities.
As an unincorporated community, Del Rey has no city council and no mayor. It doesn't have a city budget. Its median household income is $26,000. So how can it foot a bill of tens of millions of dollars? The simplest option would be to raise water rates, like what Fresno did to pay for its new surface water treatment plant. But Del Rey has only 1,600 residents. This is a form of inequity Ventura is trying to prevent.
We don't want a situation where wealthier communities have safe drinking water, but because of cost, communities like Del Rey are allowed to get sick.
State grants are an option too, but they typically cover only upfront costs. Senate Bill 623, making its way through Sacramento, would establish a fund for long-term costs, but the bill has yet to pass, and it would take time to be implemented. There is, however, another option. Sue. Todd Robbins is an attorney with Robbins Borgay Law Firm in San Francisco. He says more and more water districts are turning to lawsuits to pay for treatment, especially since the regulation took effect.
It is well over 50, and by the end of this month, it could be pretty close to 60 in terms of the total number of communities and water systems that have sued in California.
Del Rey is one of them. So who are they suing? Dow Chemical Company and Shell Chemicals, who manufactured fumigants containing 123 TCP until the 1980s. Most of the dozen or so water districts who've closed their cases have been successful, either winning in court or settling.
We have been able to have fruitful settlement negotiations, and Dow and Shell have been willing to pay significant treatment costs to our clients in order to avoid a trial.
Dow declined to comment on this story, though Shell did return an email statement suggesting the state's limit on 123 TCP is too restrictive. Litigation takes years, but in Del Rey, Carlos Arias is hopeful. 7 years after the community filed its lawsuit, a court date has been scheduled for February. For Arias, it can't come soon enough.
Our people cannot wait any longer. Our people need to have this issue resolved. The sooner, the better.
And it could be really soon if the companies decide to settle out of court. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A jury last week awarded a California man with terminal cancer $289 million in a lawsuit against chemical giant Monsanto. The jury agreed with plaintiff Dwayne Johnson's claim that his exposure to the popular herbicide Roundup on the job and the main ingredient known as glyphosate resulted in his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. With over $250 million in punitive damages in this one case alone, the stakes are high for Monsanto's owner Bayer. So where does the legal fight go from here, even beyond this immediate case, which is likely to be appealed? Joining us now is someone who has experience in these issues. Richard Stevens is an internationally renowned cancer researcher at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine and has been writing about the trial and the legal fights that are likely to come for everyone from Salon to WBUR to The Conversation. He joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Joe. It's good to be here.
So I want to talk about the path forward in a moment, but first let's talk about the main issues at hand in this trial. Back in 2015, the WHO's International Agency for Research on Cancer weighed in on this issue and said that glyphosate is a probable human carcinogen. You've worked with the IARC on a number of different occasions. How does this process work, and what does it mean that something is a probable human carcinogen based on their standard?
Well, probable means there's credible evidence, but it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. A class one carcinogen by the IARC is something like smoking or ionizing radiation, where the scientists feel there's no doubt that this agent can cause cancer.
So in this case, it's found in studies on laboratory animals. Is that the difference between this study that was undertaken by this international agency versus an epidemiological study on humans?
The way the IARC does this is they invite, for each agent that they evaluate, they invite about 25 scientists from around the world, and they call it the working group. And this includes about 6 or 7 epidemiologists, 6 or 7 toxicologists, and 6 or 7 basic scientists. So the epidemiologists like me, we do observational studies in humans. Are smokers more likely to get lung cancer or not? Those are difficult studies to do. The toxicologists then give the chemical or whatever it is to rats and mice to see if they get cancer and what kind of cancer. And then the basic science is something like putting the chemical in a test tube and seeing if it damages DNA. So the process takes about 10 days for each agent that's evaluated, in this case glyphosate, in 2015. And they all come together, the toxicologists, epidemiologists, basic scientists, and they have to come to consensus. Do we think this is a proven, yes, it is a carcinogen or hazard, a cancer hazard, or is it a probable, that's a 2A, or a 2B is a possible. So there's a whole list of classifications.
So there's a spectrum then where these things fall based on the science of the day. Is that the type of thing that evolves over time?
Yes, it is. In fact, IARC reevaluates agents as new evidence comes along, as it should. Sometimes it upgrades, and sometimes it actually downgrades an agent.
And we'll talk about some of the history there in a moment. Now, there was other evidence presented in the trial. Specifically, this IARC study was controversial. The company, as one might expect, took issue with it. And there were other scientific studies that the company brought out that said, hey, this is not a carcinogen, or at least we haven't seen the type of evidence there. Is that unusual to have such a diversity in conclusions from different researchers?
No, that is not unusual. And in fact, I teach my students, and I believe this, and I talk to my other faculty members, I think that the way we do science is a lot like a trial and a jury trial, because we're presenting evidence to each other. We're trying to prove things. Well, what is proof? What does that mean? And I say this to my scientific colleagues, and they're very uncomfortable with it, but proof to me is a consensus of experts. That's all it is. It's all it can be. And so that means something that's been proven can be unproven by new experts and new evidence. So this jury and this trial, they were presented evidence very persuasively, evidently, by the plaintiff's lawyers, and they came to the conclusion, as you said earlier, that not only was Monsanto negligent, that was the compensatory damages of $39 million, but in addition, they did punitive damages of $250 million. That means that the jury believed that Monsanto deliberately suppressed or withheld information that glyphosate did cause cancer, withheld that information from the public.
And that came in the form of emails that were entered into evidence from Monsanto dating back a number of years, painting a less than sympathetic picture of how seriously the company treated this issue of health concerns. That's a different sort of thing than what scientists normally deal with, though, isn't it?
Well, yes, this is a matter of motive. Now, I have not seen those emails, and I cannot evaluate whether Monsanto did, in fact, cover something up. I don't know. But the idea of selective presentation of data, I shouldn't say this if my scientific colleagues are listening, it's not so pristine. We're doing our best, but we're human beings, too. And we all have biases as human beings, and I do my best to do objective science. But I do have things I would like to see. So we try to avoid this, selectively present evidence. Now, the epidemiologic evidence, these are necessarily observational studies. We cannot do experiments in people. So we need, and the other thing that's really too bad is it's easy to do epidemiology badly. So you can have two studies that have very different conclusions. And this is part of the IARC's mandate, is to have experts really get into the nuts and bolts of these studies to see which ones are credible evidence, one way or the other.
How different is that than the legal system and the burden of proof there versus that scientific consensus that you're talking about? You have experience, you know, your groundbreaking research on breast cancer and how circadian rhythm disruptions and things like that have contributed to that disease is an example. How, in your experience, did it play out building that scientific consensus? Is there a lot of give and take between different researchers and pushback? I think there's a level of opaqueness from the public. We don't really know how this peer review process works. We don't understand it. It's maybe above our pay grade. How did it work in your experience?
Well, again, I think it's not that mystical a process. I mean, the scientific process and health and medicine, it's very much like this. Up until about 20 years ago, it had been proven that ulcers were caused by acid in the stomach. It had been proven. All the gastroenterologists and everybody said it was true. And then a guy came along named Barry Marshall, and he said, no, it's caused by a bacteria. And he was vilified. He's an MD, but he was just vilified. It can't be true. It's not possible. Turned out it was. And that's Helicobacter pylori. It's now been proven that it's the cause of ulcers and stomach cancer. And so it can be a long, hard process. In my own experience, there was a great deal of resistance to the idea that lighting, light at night, just turn on a light bulb. How could that hurt you? What's toxic about a light bulb? And then people started to think about this whole area is moving very fast, by the way, circadian biology. But a light bulb, if it's too bright in the evening, it's going to change your physiology back to daytime physiology, which cannot be good.
In the most recent piece that you published just within the last few hours, really, on this issue and the most recent judgment in this case against Monsanto, you looked at a couple of different case studies and offering different examples of how this might go, as this is certain to set off a lot more cases like this. Looking back at history, you cite two examples, the first being the asbestos industry and the Johns Manville Company. Tell me about that and how that wound up working out and making its way through the legal and scientific communities.
Well, it is a very interesting case because asbestos is a miracle product. It's just marvelous. It's so good at so many things. And it was very, very popular. And then it turned out that the epidemiologic studies, observational studies in people, found that the workers who were getting exposed to it, they got sick. They got real sick. They got mesothelioma, pleural lung cancer type of thing. And at first, the industry didn't want to hear that. The public didn't want to hear that because it's such a marvelous product. But it became overwhelming, and it went through the courts, lots of litigation, and it bankrupted Johns Manville in 1982. Now, that's one side. Asbestos really is dangerous if you inhale it. But, you know, the dose makes the poison. We have things in our food. We add iron to a lot of our cereals. Iron, if you give iron to rats in sufficient quantity, it causes cancer. Iron is a potent prooxidant, but it's also an essential nutrient. So it's a matter of balance. But in the asbestos case, it bankrupted the company because it became clear it was a serious cancer hazard. But there still is asbestos in some products.
And then you paint another picture with a different product that also inspired product liability suits that wound up going the other way, and that's the artificial sweetener saccharin. How did the consensus change there, and what did it mean for that industry?
It was a similar thing. Saccharin was a miracle because especially people who were somewhat overweight, but they still wanted sweet drinks. They didn't want to put sugar in it, so they got this marvelous thing called saccharin. And this back in the 60s was invented back in the 19th century. But then some researchers in the early 70s gave saccharin to some mice and got some bladder cancers. And this really got a lot of publicity. And so the FDA and others were really wanted to ban saccharin. And there was a big public outcry. And then it sort of went the opposite direction. More research was done. It turned out that the particular bladder cancer in the rat was by a mechanism that can't happen in people. So these animal studies are important to do, but they're not human cancer. And so it may be one type of cancer in a rat that really has nothing to do with human cancer hazard. And then the epidemiologic studies the observational studies just did not see associations of intake of saccharin and cancer in general.
And so then the consensus reversed.
Yes.
How unusual is that?
Gosh, there's so many products. I mean, we have hundreds of new chemicals come on the market all the time. I don't think it's that unusual. I think these kinds of back and forth are happening all the time. That's why it's so tough for things like the Environmental Protection Agency and NIOSH, National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, OSHA, for setting standards in the workplace and in the environment, and the FDA for food. What are you allowed to put in food and what not? It's a constant, important societal problem of cost versus benefit.
One of the other issues that came out in this trial, and it's not unique to this case at all, but it's when companies get involved with science and funding academic research and things like that, how good of a job do you think the research field is doing at policing itself and ensuring that there's transparency? There were allegations that in some cases there was ghostwriting of studies and things by Monsanto in this case. I know that you've put out the disclosure that you don't have any interest financially in any of the players in this and
right.
have been following that protocol, which many researchers do. But how good of a job do you think your colleagues do? And is this something that could be improved on, and if so, how?
Well, you mean in the scientific endeavor in general? There have been lots of scandals about eminent researchers either fudging data or working clandestinely with some industry or other. But it's a human enterprise. Again, we have these problems in every human enterprise. I think overall, biomedical science in America is very carefully done. And pretty well self-policed. There's a lot of big egos involved. And when somebody comes up with a new set of data, everybody, a lot of other people want to tear it apart. So that's true for the basic science as well as the clinical work and the epidemiology.
So those egos serve an important role, I guess.
Yes. It's a lot of sparring and jabbing and what have you.
Richard Stevens is a professor of the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, a groundbreaking cancer researcher, and has been doing some fascinating research on circadian disruption and the way it can cause changes in hormones relevant to breast cancer risk. He has been writing about the trial Johnson versus Monsanto. A jury awarded $289 million to the plaintiff in that case last week, suggesting that Mr. Johnson's cancer was caused by exposure to Monsanto's product Roundup, which contains the weed killer glyphosate. That is something that will continue to make its way through the legal system, both in this case, almost certain to be appealed, and likely other cases along those lines as well. You can find Mr. Stevens' article and others online at theconversation.com, as well as on Salon and WBUR. Mr. Stevens, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Joe. It was great to be here.
Summers for college students usually mean part-time jobs or summer school, but this is an election year. And for one group of students, it means civic engagement, things like registering voters and getting them out to the polls in November. While some of them are new voters themselves, FM89's Laura Tsutsui reports they're hoping to get other young adults to make voting a priority.
This summer, 25 students from UC Santa Cruz and UC Merced have returned to where they grew up in the Central Valley to try to increase voter turnout among young adults. It's all part of the Central Valley Freedom Summer Project. Veronica Tariquez launched the project this year. As a sociology professor at UC Santa Cruz, Tariquez started this because of a trend she noted among students from the Central Valley.
As a professor, I see that a lot of students from the Central Valley don't go back, so there's a brain drain.
She says that not only were students choosing to settle down away from the Valley, but the young adults who stayed weren't very engaged in local issues. Tariquez has studied youth organizing and civic engagement, and she says that while most metropolitan areas do a good job of educating young voters, she sees that breakdown in the Central Valley.
Particularly in Los Angeles and in the Bay Area, where there has been kind of a civic infrastructure to support young people's engagement around a range of issues. These efforts tend to be a bit smaller in the Central Valley, where there isn't that civic infrastructure.
As part of the Central Valley Freedom Summer Project, Tariquez paired students with nonprofits throughout the Valley. These students have spent the summer trying to connect with young voters by hosting conferences about civic engagement, making presentations on local issues, and holding voter registration drives. They're trying to get young adults to see what impact their votes could have. Back in 2016, during California's primary election, only 18% of young adults ages 18 to 25 even turned out to vote. That's half the amount of total eligible voters in the state who turned out for that election. In general, young adult voter turnout is low compared to the rest of the population, especially during midterm election years. For some of the interns, this is only their second or third election. Kathy De La Cruceros is 21 and a student at UC Santa Cruz. She knows firsthand that it's easy to ignore voting.
I didn't register to vote, truthfully, until I was a sophomore in college. I had help because my parents never really showed me. I wasn't very interested either. I was like, oh, whatever, like, that doesn't matter for me. And I was there also. And so now I measure success by really, like, making a connection with somebody. A change in my mindset is what I'm shooting for.
De La Cruceros is spending her summer in Porterville, which is where she grew up. She says that when she's registering people to vote, they often ask who they should vote for.
And, like, that kind of drives me crazy because I'm like, what do you mean? Like, it's kind of funny when we tell them, like, no, like, we're not voting for anybody. We really just want to, like, register you to vote and that's it. And they're like, oh, I guess, yeah, like, I'll do that. And then it's just really funny because all we want to do is really give them the skills. Like, that's our main goal.
The Central Valley Freedom Summer Project is nonpartisan, so none of the interns can say what or who they're voting for anyway. Jose Orellana is another intern in the South Valley. While he's participated in elections before, this is his first experience in community organizing.
There's this saying by, like, older folks that say that young adults don't care. But that's not yes and no. Because first of all, you need to be educated on why you should care about those issues. And that's what we're trying to do by putting local conferences all over the Central Valley.
I asked Orellana and De La Cruceros if they thought their efforts would really carry over from the summer into the November election, and both of them are optimistic.
We've been doing all this work, but hopefully it's going to turn out. You know, in the 2016 election, 100 million eligible voters didn't turn out. So all this work connecting with youth, you know, telling them, hey, it's so important, it only takes a few minutes, all that constant remindering and organizing that's usually not really cared for, that it really matters.
Every youth conference that we've been to, we've seen so many, like, excited faces, and you can tell that this is new to them. You know, you can tell that these students have never been exposed. Like, when I talk about water and telling them that my whole community ran out of water, people are like, oh my God. So I hope that everybody takes this, like, to heart, and I think that we are making change. We are really planting the seed.
It won't be until after the November election that the project can analyze whether their efforts actually increased voter participation. But Tarika says hosting events now means newly registered voters will hopefully be prepared when it's time to vote in November. Since UC Santa Cruz doesn't start school until September, both Orellana and De La Cruceros plan to stay in the Valley, registering and talking to new and young voters until then. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We're at the start of another school year, and that means more than just a focus on basic academic skills. In Fresno County, there's a new push underway to address mental health and well-being amongst school children. It's part of a five-year, $111 million campaign that's called All for Youth, that's bringing together the county's Office of Education and the Behavioral Health Department to provide a variety of new services to schools across the county, rural areas, urban areas. Here to tell us more is Dewan Utek, the director of the county's Behavioral Health Department. Dewan, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, before we talk about how you're bringing together everything from school behavior issues to suicide prevention and triage, let's talk about the problem and the need out there. How would you assess sort of the gaps in addressing mental health needs of school-aged children in Fresno County presently?
Well, there's a lot of issues around access to care. We have kids across the county in both rural and urban areas. Many times the kids who need services through our department, those are kids typically who have Medi-Cal or who are indigent. To get to our services requires either use of public transportation, a parent to take time off work, or the child to take time out of school. And so there's always access issues, even if the services are available. And we know, generally speaking, that there's a lot of kids who need services. And so part of what this program will do, we hope, is increase access to services for all kids.
Yeah, I know in rural areas, even in Metro Fresno, can be sometimes challenging to access mental health care, let alone in Fireball or Mendota or somewhere out in a rural area. This program is kind of unique, though, in it takes an integrated approach at the school sites on everything from school discipline to more severe mental and emotional disturbances with children. How significant is that?
It's really the comprehensive approach that's important to us. We don't want to just provide services to kids who have what we call serious emotional disturbances. And historically, we provide services to kids who have Medi-Cal or who are indigent. But the concept behind this program is that we would provide prevention, early intervention, and that includes things like screening for high-risk kids, and then what we call specialty mental health services, which is what traditionally would be considered treatment. And all of those are needs within our county for kids. And the other thing about the contract is it's really 0 to 22. So when we think of school age, we don't always encompass those younger and older ages. But for us, that's the youth population that we serve.
So you're seeing that there's connections then, not only on the care side, but also on for lack of a better term, the causation side, dealing with, you know, things we sort of look at as standalone. We'll, you know, in our coverage here on this station, we've reported a lot on trauma, early childhood trauma. We've reported on the school behavioral training as they're trying to get away from suspensions and expulsions, this PBIS system. What you're saying is that all of these things are kind of related, even aside from just providing services, but one issue can affect another and can perhaps lead to other mental health challenges.
Yeah, and in our area, the types of things that make a child predisposed to perhaps needing specialty mental health services, poverty, which we know we have really high rates of, trauma in kids' lives, as you mentioned, we know. And oftentimes kids of school age will, if they experience trauma, might have behaviors that don't necessarily tie directly back to the trauma. So they might, what we would refer to as misbehave in class, but really the causation of that was the trauma that occurred to them. And so helping educate the school staff, including teachers, on how to recognize that and then providing resources so that we can intervene and really address the underlying problem, not just the behavior that's being exhibited in the classroom. We're really looking at this as a partnership between my department and the schools, where we work hand in hand and leverage the resources that each of us have. You mentioned PBIS or Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports. That's a program that we've supported financially to be in the schools for some time. We have had clinicians in schools for some time. But this agreement, this partnership really looks to bring all of that together and enhance and grow the resources.
So how do you see this playing out in reality? How is it physically going to work? Are you going to have specialists at all of these campuses? Or are they going to be roving? Or is it going to be training, as you just mentioned, awareness for existing faculty and things like that? How does it work in reality as you envision it?
Yes and yes and yes. Essentially, what it will look like is a hub and spoke model. So there will be regional hubs, and this is modeled after a program in San Bernardino County called Desert Mountain, where in a county our size, and we're over 6,000 square miles, having a regional hub where the specialty services and staff are located. And so some kids might get their services there. But then the goal is to eventually have clinicians available to every school. Now, some of those clinicians, based on need, may be full-time at a school, and other clinicians may go to multiple schools to meet their needs. It'll really be based on need. And that's really part of this partnership, is putting more structure and formality to identifying the need at different schools and ensuring that the resources match the need of individual schools and the students that they have going to school there and their families.
There's been a lot in the news recently. Just, you know, there have been some very tragic circumstances with students taking their own lives and have received attention this beyond the immediate campuses. And that is something that's always a concern, but especially now. How does this project aim to look at the issue of suicide prevention?
Well, we have a suicide prevention collaborative locally that the schools have been a big part of since it convened about a year and a half ago. And as you know, there's recent legislation that requires schools to have policies and procedures and plans for how they will address suicide prevention. And so how this partnership will support that is through education and training of school staff, parents, and students on recognizing signs and symptoms of a child who might be struggling with a mental health issue, a substance use disorder issue, or in some sort of crisis. And that crisis could be suicidal thoughts or ideation. And then putting the resources in place so that when that's recognized, the child has access to services that might assist them with that.
Moving on in this discussion with issues like, you know, school shootings and things like that, and there's always in the media afterwards, second guessing, well, somebody should have spotted something. Someone should have intervened at some point. Is this type of program designed to try to spot students who may be struggling with something that might otherwise be going overlooked?
Well, this partnership will do a couple of things that I think will create more resilient schools and resilient students. One is on the prevention and early intervention side, really teaching kids how to recognize emotions and feelings and how to manage those emotions and feelings in healthy, productive ways. And then also educating, again, parents and students and school staff, including teachers and other staff, how to recognize a child who might be struggling. And again, part of the plan, which is essential, is it's on the one hand great to recognize that there's a problem, but you have to have the resources, a place to send kids to. So whether we're talking about a child who's struggling with a trauma they've experienced or a child who's actually having suicidal thoughts or behavior, it's making sure that the people understand how to recognize that and how to link the child to services. Where do you get services? How do you talk to someone? And that's part of the training that will be offered through the partnership.
So this is a big expansion. It's been well documented. The Valley has a shortage of healthcare providers from physicians, general practice to psychiatric care. Is it going to be a challenge to fill this and make this work and find all the people necessary to make it happen?
It is absolutely going to be a challenge for us. However, at the same time, if we don't begin to offer the services, we'll never attract people to the profession either. And so it's our belief that, you know, it will take some time to build the program. We know that there's all kinds of practical matters that have to occur to be able to offer services. And so while we're doing that, we're also working with the schools, including the community colleges and the California State Universities and UCs on how do we build the workforce. And there's a statewide effort going on right now around workforce to really strategize for the future. We know that for behavioral health professions, the Central Valley region has some of the lowest availability of staff than any part of California, and California tends to be lower overall. And so that is absolutely part of the strategy here, is to begin to grow more clinicians and psychiatrists and psychologists and all kinds of mental health workers to help meet the need.
So where do we go from here? It's the start of a new school year. This is a major new program, 5 years, $111 million funded through Medi-Cal money. But where are we in the timeline of rolling this out?
We're in what we call the ramp-up period, and I would say probably one of our biggest challenges right now is managing expectations. As the schools hear about this exciting new resource and benefit for them, they're chomping at the bit, and everybody wants to get in line first to get their needs met. And so we are in the process of working with the Fresno County Superintendent of Schools to put the program together, to hire the staff, to get the sites what we call certified, to be able to provide Medi-Cal services, and to identify the locations where those services will begin to be provided. So the first couple of locations will be in the western part of the county, in the Fireball, Mendota area, and that will be a regional hub. from a geography perspective. And then in downtown Fresno, we'll offer an age-based hub, so for infant mental health, so for very young age. And then over the next few years, we'll expand those hubs to all areas of the county.
It's a fascinating new program that is really looking at a lot of different things, from suicide prevention to behavioral situations in school. It's part of a five-year, $111 million campaign called All for Youth. That's bringing together the County Office of Education and the Behavioral Health Department with Fresno County to bring mental health services into county schools. Dewan Utek, director of the Behavioral Health Program, with us today. Dewan, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. In April 1997, Jocelyn Detloff's life changed forever. On a camping trip in sub-Saharan Africa, an accident left her paralyzed. It also put her life on a new path, inspiring others, as she describes in her book, It Rained in the Desert, One Woman's Story of Spirit and Resilience. She'll be the keynote speaker for Resources for Independent Central Valley at their 42nd Annual Recognition Dinner this Friday, August 17th at Pardini's in Fresno. The Valley nonprofit encourages people with disabilities to be in control of their lives and to live more independently through a variety of different opportunities. Jocelyn joins us now. Jocelyn, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
I know you've told this story many times, but for our listeners who maybe haven't read your book or haven't heard you speak, walk us through what happened in your life in April 1997.
Yeah, just to give a little bit of background information, at this point in my life, I had already graduated from college. I went to the University of Michigan, and I graduated with a degree in English literature. And I was one of those people who did not know what I wanted to do with my life. So I traveled quite a bit after graduation. My graduation present to myself was a six-week trip through Europe. Then I went backpacking through Australia and New Zealand for a year. And then I decided that sub-Saharan Africa was my next destination. So I was on a camping trip that started in Kenya, and that was to end up in Cape Town, South Africa. But just over 2 months into my trip, I was in an area called Sussex Fly in Namibia, and they have some of the largest sand dunes in the world. And so we were sledding down a sand dune. And I grew up in Michigan, so I grew up sledding down snow hills, and why would sand be different? But it was, and the board that I was on hit a mound of dirt at the bottom of the dune. The board stopped, and I did not. And from what people say, I flew 50 to 100 meters, somersaulted, landed, and I broke my back at the thoracic 5 level, which paralyzed me from the chest down. I still have full use of my arms and hands and that sort of thing. But it paralyzed me instantly and changed my life.
What was your initial experience after the accident?
Initially, I had to wait for 3.5 hours for a plane to come and get me because we were in the middle of the desert. And I went to the capital city of Windhoek in Namibia, was there for 3 weeks. They did surgery there to stabilize my spine. And then I came back to the States, back to Michigan, where I'm from, and went to Grand Rapids, Michigan, to the Mary Freebed Rehabilitation Hospital, which is now it's one of the fourth largest rehab systems in the country, and did rehab. My attitude at the time was, well, okay, I can't do anything to change my current situation, so I wanted to do whatever I could to stay independent, get working again, just moving on with my life, because, when I was laying in the hospital in Africa, I had this little voice inside of me, that says, this is going to be okay. So I didn't have those initial outbursts of anger or, oh my gosh, why me? But I just really, from the start, wanted to move on.
You mentioned when we began this conversation that you were at a point in your life then where you didn't really know exactly what you wanted to do. You had graduated college. given that, and given the fact that you went through this extremely traumatic event, both physically and I'm also sure emotionally, were you at a precarious spot there? Would it have been easy to have that define you? Because you talk in your book about wanting in your desire to not be defined by your disability. Would it have been easy to maybe go the other way?
Perhaps, but, you know, I just, you know, at one point in our lives, usually as teenagers or whatever, you know, we want to be different. We want to, you know, stand out. We don't want to be like everybody else. And then, you know, after something like this happening, you know, I'm like, I just want to blend in. I just want to be like everybody else. I don't want, you know, people to look at me in any sort of strange ways or so. I have to say, you know, I was 26 when my accident happened, and I spent a lot of time in this world walking on two legs and having, you know, now navigating the world on four wheels. It's a very stark difference between how people treat you, what they assume you can do and what you can't do. Looking at me, I don't know if people would immediately assume that, oh, I'm a college graduate. I am now actually the annual fund director for the Mary Freebed Foundation. I've written a book. I travel. I play tennis. There's all these things that I think people may not necessarily think, oh, wow, people with disabilities can do that. So I did get into the resources for Independent Central Valley. We have a sister organization similar to that here in Grand Rapids called Disability Advocates of Kent County. And I actually started working for them about 2 years after my accident and got involved a little bit with some advocacy. And that's where I started to learn about fundraising and that sort of thing. And I was there for 14 years, and I learned a ton. And then about 5 years ago, started at the Mary Freebed Foundation.
Was there anyone early on in your experience that really helped you, not just physically, but on this path that you're on now and sharing this message of resilience? How did other people help you in that journey?
Well, a lot of times, if I go and speak to somebody who's newly injured or something like that. Unfortunately, the world that we live in, I tell people, and I've always felt this way, that it is up to us to make other people feel comfortable. And the more okay we seem with everything, the more comfortable people will be. The doctors and nurses and therapists and everything at Mary Freebed are phenomenal because they really want to help you achieve whatever goals you want. And one of my goals after Africa was I was going to go to Ireland for 3 months and work. And then after that, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew that I wanted at that stage in my life to live by myself and have my own place because that's something that I hadn't done before. So despite breaking my back and being paralyzed and using a wheelchair, I didn't see any reason why that goal should change. So after 8 weeks of being in inpatient rehab, I moved into my own apartment in Grand Rapids, Michigan to live on my own, you know, meeting this one gentleman who plays wheelchair tennis. His name is Brian Barton. He was very influential in my deciding, oh, am I going to get a car? Am I going to get a van? And I decided to get a car because he showed me how he was able to get in and out of the car, take his wheelchair apart, get it in. So, you know, it's seeing people who live the life every day that were very influential in adjusting. But then one of the sports that I got involved with playing was wheelchair tennis. And really being around so many wheelchair athletes, you know, people don't play this sport if they're sissies and if they want to sit around and mope all the time. You know, to play a sport, you know, you have to be motivated and you have to want to do it. And I learned a lot about equipment and I learned a lot about how you do things, how you live, about so many things, and made some really great friendships through it.
Were there any people early on at that time who were saying, you know, Jocelyn, I don't think this is a good idea. Maybe you should do this instead. Maybe you should do that instead. That might be, you need to readjust your expectations. Did you have those voices around you?
No, not really, because I've always been pretty independent on the stubborn side, and I will tell you that's my it is a blessing and a curse. But I just really had wonderful family and friends, people to support me and help me when I needed it. You know, one of the hardest things that I've really had to learn to do or learn to be better at is asking for help. Clearly, physically I can't do what I used to be able to do. And I've never wanted people to think any less of me because I couldn't do a particular thing. But in order to be independent, in order to live like I do, sometimes I need the help to do it. And so I've gotten a lot better at asking. And my gosh, if people are asked, I mean, they're more than willing to do something to help you out.
What would your message be for people who are not personally dealing with a disability? Maybe what you would want them to understand, or maybe misconceptions that are out there?
One of the key things is there's a huge difference between accessible and inclusive. You know, I wish that I could, maybe I should have gone into architecture or something, because a lot of times, you know, I hate stairs, mainly because I can't use them, but also, you know, if you have stairs instead of a ramp, or, you know, if you had a ramp, then everybody could use the ramp. And, you know, stairs can really divide people. And one of my, you know, big things is that, you know, if you're with somebody who uses a chair, well, you know, if they take the elevator, then you take the elevator. Or if they push up the ramp, then you go up the ramp with them. And a lot of times with building design, you know, the stairs may be in one location, but, oh, the elevator is like down the hall and to the right. So if the elevator and the stairs had, you know, like the same general entry and exit points, that would be an example of more inclusive design. But, and, you know, if you, it is no big secret that people are afraid of what they don't know. And, you know, even looking somebody right in the eye and saying hello, that kind of a thing. You know, if you would do it for somebody who doesn't have a disability, do it for somebody who does, too.
We've been talking with author Jocelyn Detloff about her book, It Rained in the Desert, One Woman's Story of Spirit and Resilience. She'll be the keynote speaker for Resources for Independent Central Valley at their 42nd Annual Recognition Dinner this Friday at Pardini's in Fresno. The Valley nonprofit encourages people with disabilities to be in control of their lives and to live more independently. Jocelyn's book is available on Amazon.com in both print and Kindle editions. Jocelyn, thank you so much.
It was a delight. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, you can send us your comments online at kvpr.org. And when you're there, subscribe to our podcast as well and take this program wherever you go and listen on demand. Again, it's the Valley Edition podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts and online at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and our reporters Carrie Klein, Monica Velez, and Christina Lopez, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.